debut episode of Rising Up for Justice featuring Jane Kim of Working Families Party. In addition to Jane, future interviews and episodes will feature Liv Cunins-Berkowitz of Jewish Voice for Peace, Nadia Marin Molina of National Day Labor Organizing Network, and Van Bailey of the Trans Youth Emergency Project. Again, that's Rising Up for Justice, a new weekly half-hour program dedicated to conversations with changemakers, exclusive to viewers of Free Speech TV and subscribers of Rising Up with Sonali, debuting on my website, risingupwithsonali.com, and on Free Speech TV the week of August 25th.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. KBOO's fall membership drive is just around the corner. Help us kick off our KBOO Out Loud Drive on August 20th for National Radio Day, where we'll bring you more of our independently made content, KBOO stories, and KBOO testimonials all day long.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Peace, good people. You're live and direct. Hard Knock Radio. This is Kalonji Changa filling in for Davey D. I told Davey last week when I was on his show that it was going to be a takeover. And as promised, here we are. Davey is in parts unknown. So I wanted to make sure that, if I'm going to rock and rep for Davey D, because Davey D is like a big deal in some parts of the universe. You know what I mean? And, we wanted to go in and take it to the East Coast, because Davey's always repping the West Coast, even though he's from New York. We already know that. But we wanted to go to one of our favorite freedom fighters, one of the few politicians we could trust, someone that's been on the front line for quite a while, no stranger to Hard Knock Radio. We have live and direct none other than our brother, Charles Barron. Brother Charles, what's going on?
Oh, morning, sir. It's always an honor to be on with you and the times I was on with Davey. And this is a timely time to be on. So always great seeing you. And, well, they can't see you, but I can. It's always great being on with you. I appreciate you, brother.
Hey, I appreciate you. For folks who are unfamiliar, because I ain't want to butcher your bio, you know what I'm saying? I get sentimental and everything. It would have been a 3-hour bio, and folks would be like, man, the show's only supposed to be an hour. First off, before we go any further, we're going to shout out Mama Inez, because I don't want no problems. Yeah, I don't want no problems.
Hey, I got to keep that domestic tranquility going, man. So you make sure you do this right. It's a good shout out. Good shout out.
Right on.
So yeah, both of us are. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. We listen.
Both of us, Inez and I, we've decided 21 years ago to get involved in the electoral arena. You know, we both come out of the movement. You know, Inez, 60 some odd years. She started 14, 15 years old. She was in active in the movement. I started 17, 18 years old. I was in the Harlem branch of the Black Panther Party, although I did my work on the Lower East Side with Felipe Luisiano and the Young Lords. But that's where I got a lot of my political ideology from the Panthers. You know, when I went up there, I said, oh man, they're going to show me how to deal with guns and all that stuff. Hey, they whipped out books. So this is your weapon. So I had to get a lot of political education. And then from the Panthers, I went to the Black United Front with Reverend Herbert Daughtry, and I became his chief of staff. And ironically, I became the chairperson of the National Black United Front's Harlem branch. Did a lot of work in that. And then I started this company called Dynamics of Leadership, Inc., Inez and I. And we went across the country doing leadership workshops, you know, rather than just assume, you know, leadership is the only profession where you don't have to have no credentials. You know, you would never allow a doctor to work on you who's not gone to medical school, or a lawyer to litigate your case who's not gone to law school, but anybody can lead you. You know, if they have charisma and they can talk, or if they self-anointed and appointed by a cult of people, or in the electoral arena, you don't have to be smart. You just have to get more votes than the other person. You don't have to know anything about leadership. So we did this thing, and we developed a field called leadership science, you know, the study of leadership. And we developed some workshops, like about 8 or 9 workshops, effective public speaking, negotiating techniques, how to organize the science, art, and creativity of organizing around issues, and then how do you take that organizing around issues to organize for power, which is a whole different kind of methodology. And we did how to organize press conferences, how to deal with the media, teamwork, how to deal with that conflict resolution, you know, how do you deal with contradictions and conflicts in leadership, and what is leadership? You know, coming up with a definition of what leadership is and what leadership is not how many times you appear on TV, is not how well you speak, or that you have charisma and you can excite a Black audience. That is not leadership. And it's not building a cult of personality. It is not how many positions is you can get. Leadership is not a position, it's a function. So we really got into that heavily. And then after I went around the country and I said, man, I'm teaching leadership to all these college students, 100,000 of them over the 5-6 years. I don't even know who they are. I could have been teaching my enemy, you know, these skills. So we said, hey, we need power. And that's what drove us into the electoral arena. It was in my beloved East New York, every time something went down, it's the sellout, neo-colonial, sycophant misleadership class in the Democratic Party that was calling all the shots. So instead of continually calling them sellout, Negroes, Uncle Toms, Ancient Mamas, and Uncle Tom was really more progressive than people give him credit for, but instead of all of that, let's take them out. That's when we started Operation Power, and we won the city council seat. We won the state assembly seat. We won the district leadership, male and female. We took over the community board, still have that, and wiped out the Democratic Club in my beloved East New York district. And we held it for 21 years and delivered schools, renovated parks, got 3 political prisoners freed along with the Jericho movement, Herman Bell, Jalil Montecum, and Seth Hayes. Was able to get a reparations bill passed. After we left, they watered it down a bit, but it was our bill. And this, I can spend the rest of this broadcast just talking about all of the things that happened. My chief of staff was Viola Plummer, may she rest in peace, and Omawale Clay from the December 12th movement. So we were able to hire revolutionaries so they can work full-time in the community, get paid, have health care, and because we were in for more than 10 years, a pension. So, you know, These were things that we brought with the electoral arena. Now we're out of the electoral arena, and we're looking at building Operation Power, using that as a model across the country to say that other radicals and revolutionaries, the challenge is to stay radical and revolutionary after you win. See, most of the time, we don't win. So your values are not tested. Your commitment is not tested with you in a seat of power, because radicals usually don't win or don't run. So we have the model, the example, that you can stay revolutionary, stay radical, stay on point, and actually win. But more importantly, after you win a seat, deliver.
That right there is a textbook example of how to utilize electoral politics as a tool. Yes. And not be utilized, not be pimped yourself. So much to unpack just from that brief piece. First of all, again, we want to thank you. And to the listeners, yes, indeed, you are listening to Hard Knock Radio. This is Kalonji Changa, and I'm filling in for Davey D. And I have my main man, Charles Barron, on the air right now. He is live. That's right. It's not an imposter. And he's telling you how to do this thing, you know. Brother Charles, I'm looking, and it's just so much going on right now. We're talking about electoral politics. But briefly, before we go any further, because you mentioned Felipe Luciano, and it reminded me, and shout out to Felipe. I just hosted a piece with the Last Poets. Of course, he's a young lord and last poet out in D.C. a few months ago, and we had a powerful time. But in mentioning Felipe, you sparked a reminder. You reminded me of the fact that one of our sisters in our liberation movement transitioned the other day, a sister who was a Panther and a young lord, and we're talking about Mama Cleo Silvers. Can you say a few words on behalf of Mama Cleo?
Well, yeah, Mama Cleo was consistent over the years in the Black Panther Party, and along with Fannie Shakur and other sisters, Joanne Chesimard, who later became Asada Shakur. And even after the Panthers, she just maintained a powerful presence, always there when the call was made, and just a powerful sister, a leader, you know, sincere to the bone, a servant to the bone. So she's going to be sorely missed. You know, I didn't have the relationship with her in the party because I did my work on the Lower East Side. But people like Afeni and her and this other sister named Joan Bird. These were people that, sisters that really got down in the party. And Elaine Brown, and they had to fight even within the party, because, you know, like in most of the movements, the male dominated movements, sisters got to struggle. So and she was one of those principal sisters who raised that struggle and served our people so well. Job well done. And she's going to be missed.
No doubt. Long live the spirit of Cleo Silvers. May she rise in power. I want to, you know, it's no secret right now. You mentioned New York. New York politics off the chain. Politics in D.C., we see Trump is, you know, I'm not even going to say at it again. It's business as usual. But I'm looking, I would like to start with New York, because that's where you're from. And I understand that it's a serious race that has been making waves around the planet. You know, talks of socialism, talks of a new form of democracy, so on and so forth. Give us your take on what's going on in New York, and, you know, give the listeners an update as to what's going on politically in New York City.
First of all, let me just do another broad general thing, and then I get to the particulars. We're not going to be able to vote our way to liberation.
Appreciate that part.
The electoral arena is not a panacea. It's another tactic, like demonstrations, like having conferences, like all of the tactics that we use. Just throw that in the tactical bag, because you're not going to be able to. There's severe limitations to the electoral arena, but there are great benefits as a tactic once you don't get caught up in it. Because remember, this is a two-party duopoly, neo-colonial capitalist system that has two major parties, Republicans and Democrats, that are connected strongly to Wall Street, the real estate industry, AIPAC, Jewish lobby, and then whoever wins those seats, are going to be the administrators of a colonial capitalist system and its imperialistic foreign policy, whether it's a Democrat, a Republican, a conservative, a liberal, a democratic socialist, whoever is in those positions, they're going to be dealing with a colonial capitalist system. So the question is, how do you get in that system and maintain a revolutionary commitment? And the challenge also is to understand that those who say, I don't want to get involved in electoral politics, you are involved in electoral politics. Whether you want to take control over it or not is another question. I don't want to engage myself in the system. We're all in the system. Nobody is outside of the capitalist system. You're paying taxes somewhere. You have a bank account. You're working for somebody. So you are involved. So to minimize the contradictions, we thought it would be good for us to get a seat of power. State power cannot be ignored. It's controlling every institution in our local communities. Every institution. When people call me up for a problem, I got a problem with sanitation, I got a problem with employment, it is the city council or the state assembly or Congress that's controlling the means of production in our neighborhoods. They're controlling all of the cultural, social, political, economic institutions and the police. So all of that is in the control. You can't ignore that. The question is how we can wrestle some of that power from the system, the two-party system, and maintain your independent revolutionary integrity. That's our challenge. Brother Cologne, that's what we're up against. And we succeeded at doing that, which is why we use us, Operation Power, as a model. Because even the DSA in New York City, just so that people will know, New York City is 8.6 million people. Of that 8.6 million people, 2 million are Africans, black. 2 point some odd million are Latino, Latinx, I don't know what to say, Latina. That's like 55% of the population of New York is black and brown. 10% is Asian. So like 62 to 65% of New York City is black, Latino, and Asian. Whites are 30 some odd percent, or 20 some odd percent. Now, I remember running for mayor just to be messing with them and getting some name recognition and fooling around. So one of the white reporters said, but you talk all of that black radical stuff and revolutionary stuff. How are you going to get the white vote? And I said, you mean the minority vote? He said, no, the white vote. I said, yeah, that's the minority vote. I don't need them. If we are 60 some odd percent people of color, I don't need the white vote. So I can say what I want and still win. Now, I know I'm just talking trash, but the point I wanted to make is that we're not the minorities. I don't subscribe to that majority-minority stuff. That's ridiculous, that double talk. No, we're not the majority-minority. We are the majority. Whites are the minority. The budget of New York City is $115 billion. That's the expense budget. And then there's a capital budget for 35,000 more, like parks and schools and building and all of that. That's $169 billion for the next 10 years, $16 billion a year. And in the city council, there's 51 city council members, and over 30 of them are black, Latino, and Asian, and women. So when you have that kind of structure, then you look at the problems in our neighborhoods, poverty, unemployment, miseducation, inadequate health care, homelessness, police terrorism. So when you look at all of that and you look at the power structure in New York, now what we did with our little bit, just our little taste of power in the corner of East New York, we stop gentrification. Our neighborhood is not gentrified. Harlem is. Bedford-Stuyvesant is, because they got neo-colonial black puppet sellouts in the Democratic Party in a position of power, because the city council determines what's going to be built in neighborhoods like East New York. So if I'm the city councilor, they have a thing called member deference. When a project, like these capitalists come with their projects, because East New York had land. LU 347 is in the zoning committee, has to go to the city council because he wants to go up 10 stories and he wants to do this and that. The chair of the committee is going to call the local council member up. They call it member deference. They defer to the local council member. Baron, do you want this project? No, sir. It's dead. No press conference, no demonstration. Seven people in that committee is going to say the local council member said no, it's dead. So when they come to my office with me having that kind of power, they say, I like that picture of Malcolm X you got there. You know, your suits are nice, because I don't wear no shirts and ties. I said, no, you don't. You don't like Malcolm, you don't like me. You just know I got juice. Now let's talk about what's the area median income requirement for your housing. That's how they gentrify, the AMI. So I would stop them and say, that's not gonna happen. This is how we're gonna make it affordable and define affordability. Now the election. Oh, you wanted to ask something first?
Oh, no. I'm really digging how you're breaking it down, because I think that it's very important that when we talk about electoral politics, folks normally or usually look at, you know, what the mayor is talking about, what the city council is talking about, so on and so forth, and they don't get this type of breakdown on just how this thing worked in real time. But I wanted to, because we can rap for about 3 hours and it'll seem like a half hour. But I wanted to tap into this mayoral campaign, because it's been big news as of late. So you know, what's going on with this whole New York City mayoral campaign? Because I know that there's been a lot of talk, and folks are talking like, you know, like Fidel Castro is back. You know what I'm saying? Like what's going on?
Well, far from it. First of all, in New York City, there's about four ways that you can win a seat. Either by getting the backing of the Democratic Party, the machine, the Republican Party, or, which is not likely because it's a Democratic city, or the Working Families Party, which is really an appendage, a progressive appendage of the Democratic Party. And then there's DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. They're not a party. They run in the elections. They run in the Democratic primary. So in New York City, we had one of the worst mayors since Rudolph Giuliani. That was Eric Adams, who is a not-so-in-the-closet Republican conservative who put some Democratic Party dressing on and who was corrupt or charged with corruption and had to suck up to and kiss parts of the anatomy of Donald Trump that he ought not to be kissing in order to stay out of jail. So when the race came down, Zoran Mamdani, who I had the opportunity to work with in the New York State Assembly. We worked in the State Assembly together. So Zoran was progressive on the issues. He supported my reparations bill. He was one of the few, along with me, who voted against the budget of New York State. You can tell a person's progressiveness and not independence enough how they vote for budgets and how they vote for development projects. So he was progressive on some of the issues. My concern, first of all, the straight talk, there's no other options. Cuomo's not an option. He's a corrupt, lying, disgraced governor who was charged with 1314 sexual abuse acts against women and had to resign. Eric is also corrupt and conservative. He was against bail reform. We had a bail reform bill that simply said, if you are on Rikers Island and you have pending a trial, a pretrial detainee, you should be released in your own recognizance if, in fact, you didn't commit a violent crime or any major offense. Nonviolent stuff, loitering, littering, you know, he's against that. He brought back Giuliani's racist street crime unit, the police, to get crime stats down. So we're back into stop and frisk, 80, 90% of our youth being stopped and frisked. He was against eliminating solitary confinement in prison. De Blasio eliminated it. He brought it back. I can go on and on about all of his stuff and how he's trying to make it easier for the developers to do housing that's gentrifying our neighborhoods. So here comes Zoran with DSA. Now, Zoran had 1% of the polling at the beginning and wound up upsetting Cuomo in the Democratic primary. Eric did not run in the Democratic primary. He waited for the general election to run independently. So what I'll tell you what I like about it, and what I want to put up a big caution for us about it. What I like about it is Zoran rocked the establishment. The Democratic Party establishment is rocked. They see a socialist coming into power. So the Wall Street and the real estate industry said, how the hell are we going to profit like we used to profit with a socialist in there? Then the Democratic Party, people like Hakeem Jeffries, a sellout, who can't endorse him right now until he gets permission from APAC, the Jewish lobby, because he wears his yarmulke more than he does a kufi. So we have to be concerned about that. Chuck Schumer, the state senator, hasn't endorsed. Then you got flip-flop, opportunistic Tish James. One minute she's with another candidate, Adrian Adams, who was a sister who headed up the council. And then the night she left Adrian Adams and went to Zoran's campaign and was introducing him at his celebration. So now the Democrats, some are jumping on ship with Zoran because they think he's going to win. Although I'll share you all with that. That's going to be a challenge too. I think he might pull it off. So here comes Zoran. We have no option. You know, we established with Omawale Clay and the D12 movement. We have the Black coalition to deal with this, because one of the things that's missing, Black Solidarity Coalition, that's what I'm looking for. We started a Black Solidarity Coalition because Kalonji was missing, and most important, no matter who gets in, Zoran, whoever, there is no powerful, strong, independent Black political movement that people have to be concerned about. So they, when they try to get the back row, here's the danger of Zoran. He won the Democratic primary without the Black vote. Cuomo beat him 44% to Zoran's 20-some-odd%. So you don't want them running around thinking that they could win in New York without the Black vote. So what he did, because the difference between the primary and the general election is an increase in turnout, tremendous increase in turnout. And then you got Republicans involved and independents involved. So you have Zoran, Andrew Cuomo, you have Eric Adams, and Curtis Sliwa, who's with the Guardian Angels, a Republican, and then this other guy who's just totally irrelevant. When they did the polls, Zoran was ahead, Cuomo was in second, Sleazy Sliwa was ahead of Eric. So Eric is last in the polls. So now my concern with Zoran, we'll probably have to go with him because there's nowhere else to go. First thing he did, he don't deal with black radicals. So he went after the democratic neo-colonial puppets. Titch met with what's his name, Jeffries, and all of them, met with the police, met with the Jews to try to convince them that he's not anti-Semitic. So what happens to Democratic or Socialist Party candidates once they want to win and once they get in, they turn political pragmatism outweighs political principles. Then I gotta win. So now we're gonna have to go with Zoran because we can't go with Cuomo. We stay out of it, you know, then we don't have no juice with nothing. But I'm trying to tell our coalition that we need to put a black agenda together, have some major events in September and October, and say anybody that wants our support has to do A, B, C, D. Now, we know he's the only way to go at this point, but don't think that you're in liberation land because a so-called socialist, you know, got elected, because that socialism is going out the window, just like Ocasio and Bernie Sanders. Their socialism went out the window. Once they got in Congress, they talked all that stuff, but who were they supporting? Biden. How could you be a progressive radical socialist, talk all that stuff, the oligarchy and this and that, and you supporting Biden? You were angry, Ocasio, because Kamala came in and you thought Biden could win. So how could you be so pragmatic that you voted for the federal budget, which funded bombs to Israel to kill the babies of Palestine, and then go to anti-genocide marches? This is what the DSA, so DSA candidates do. I met with some of them in City Hall. Four or five of them got elected with me. We had City Hall. I said, we got to vote against this budget. We got to vote against this speaker. We can't vote for Adrian Adams. She's real estate. They all voted for Adrian Adams. Why? Because they wanted to get a chair to a committee. They wanted to get their legislation passed, and the speaker has a lot of influence over that. So, you know, I'm glad he disturbed the whole nation, but we need to be vigilant and intelligent in responding to that, to say that, yeah, we ain't doing a lesser to evil, so we don't think you're evil. You're way better than the rest, but you can't ignore a black agenda and say, throw us into the universe. Watch out for that, listeners. When they throw you in the universe, this is a free transportation for all.
Right.
This is a pre-K for all my behind.
You get. We're listening. We got Brother Charles started over here, ladies and gentlemen. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, man, we gonna get white ball. This is, you're listening to Charles Barron. This is Kalonji Changa. We are live. This is Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Network. Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Network. Shout out to Davey D. And it sounds like Brother Charles will not be dusting off his beret to move around New York City with the Guardian Angels this year. So, but instead, you can catch him right here on Hard Knock Radio. The listeners are listening. Charles, I think I'm probably gonna get banned from all airways messing with Charles. You know what I'm saying? No APAC money for Kalonji. You know what I'm
saying? You blew that one, bro.
Thanks, Brother Charles. It was all good that you came along. Hakeem Jeffries, I will not be joining you for lunch. So, Brother Charles, DC, you know, folks, you know, I'm a respectfully say, your homeboy is at it again. straight out of New York, Donald Trump, DT. You know, I think he's from the same district Brother Charles is from. I'm not sure.
No, however, we don't allow him in our neighborhood.
I thought he bought the neighborhood. I guess y'all put a stop to that. Right now, folks are, you know, They've been in a frenzy since January, acting as if, you know, this is some type of phenomena. You know, I'm reminded of Gil Scott-Heron with his song where he talks about it ain't no new thing. And of course, absolutely,
right.
Yeah, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it ain't no new thing. Let's talk about DC. Let's talk about, you know, you have troops in DC. Trump's telling them they can do what they want to do. You know, be a head buster if you want to, whatever you have to do. We're going to restore law and order. We've heard this this type of rhetoric for decades and decades, going back to Nixon and LBJ and Reagan and, you know, any politician you could think of here in the halls of North America. What's your take? What's going on in D.C., Brother Charles?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, restore law and order. He should have thought about that on January 6th. When his maniac was tearing up the place and a police officer even died. So it was what law and order. What's going on now is that Trump used the power of like emergency. He's supposed to be able to say without Congress or anybody else that we have an emergency situation and prove it. Crime is out of hand. So therefore he can bring in the National Guard or take over for 30 days. Then after 30 days, it has to go to Congress in order to be a law that he could stay in longer. Matter of fact, even before 30 days, for 48 hours, he's able to do it. Then he has to go to Congress, a certain committee, to ask, can he extend it to the 30 days? So, you know, Democrats and Republicans are, you know, they're in compliance with this stuff. They talk all of that stuff. So that's one thing. The second thing is crime went down in just about every category in Washington, D.C. So there's no justification of crime is the problem. Thirdly, and most importantly, he's against D.C. becoming a state. And so were the Democrats when they were in. How come after all these years, Washington, D.C. is not a state? And he was saying, no, can't become a state. We won't have that. And then homelessness. You want to really help D.C.? And you're concerned about those encampments that make you look bad in the White House because they're not far from the White House? Put them into permanent apartments with subsidized rent, like Cuomo cut in New York, and we had to fight to get that done. But so all of this is his way of projecting power, and the fascism always exists in America. You know, the difference between the fascism now is you see it clearly than the fascism of Biden, who tried to put the Uhuru 3 in jail for free speech, for speaking, right. Is that we have to argue with our people. See, when Democrats in power, we have to argue with our people to show them that they're corrupt, that they're fascist, that they're colonialist, that they're imperialist, that they're no good. We have to argue with our people to get them to see that in Biden and Kamala Harris and Obama and Clinton. It's a hard argument. With Trump, there's no discussion. You see it clearly. The question is, what do you do about it? So, and that's where, you know, I say local politics come in. And I'll explain that in a minute. So what he's doing in D.C. is saying, okay, let me start right at home, you know, where this stuff is happening next to the White House. And then I'll go to New York. New York crime statistics are down. By the way, when these politicians say crime is down statistically, yes, it is, but our communities are not safe. And while they focus on crime and policing, the real crime is poverty, unemployment, inadequate health care, miseducation, homelessness, the unhoused. That's the real problem. And in New York, that has not put a dent in that, Eric. But so you just giving us police crime stats. Like, I can brag in my East New York neighborhood, high crime, one of the highest crime neighborhoods. Since I've been in office, crime went down. But East New York is not safe as it should and could be. And it's not safe because of poverty. No, I don't know of anybody in East New York that has decided to get into crime, got up in the morning and said, you know what? There's not enough police out here. I think I'll be a criminal. Right. They haven't built enough prisons. I think I'll be a criminal. Hey, these laws are lenient. I think I'll be a criminal. Nobody gets into crime because of these reasons that they're saying we have to combat crime with.
I have to respectfully disagree with you on that, because I think that Trump woke up one day and said he wanted to be a criminal, and you know, so I think you're wrong on that, Brother Charles. I mean, you know, I was with you.
So you said, I'll join you in that one. That's an exception. He's an exception.
Right on. Okay.
He's an exception. But so yes. With crime, getting to the root causes of crime, it's poverty, it's unemployment, it's miseducation, it's the unhoused. And you look, inflation. Food costs so much in New York, you'll come out cheaper eating your money than buying food. So these are the things that cause people to take desperate actions and get into things for survival reasons. And then mental health is an issue. You done destroyed us mentally, psychologically. We are the people that you raped, that you kidnapped. We are the people that you castrated, that you hung in front of our children. We are the people that you developed the prison industrial complex for. We are the people that you did convict leasing with. So you do all of this and think we supposed to be in our right mind after that, and you lock us in these so-called, I call them, you know, domestic colonies called black communities, and then think we're just going to sit there and then say, you just got to work hard. Really? If that was the case, we'd be liberated yesterday. So none of that stuff is being addressed. And so Trump comes along, Eric Adams comes along, and they put emphasis on a police state to keep crime down. And then they come up with their statistics that show that crime is down. But I could tell you for a fact, in New York City, 30% to 40% poverty in every black and brown community, double digit unemployment and homelessness, and our youth don't know what to do. You tell them to go to school to get an education. I have so many people that came by my office with college degrees that couldn't find a gig. So let's not lose focus on what's going on here. Now, after saying all of that, Brother Cologne G, this is going to sound real crazy. We're winning. Winning. They're imploding. The Democratic Party is imploding. The Republican Party is imploding. The American empire internationally is declining. The American dollar is declining. The liberation of the Sahel region and the creation of BRICS, all of that is attacking the American empire to the point that they pushed forth a Donald Trump. 77 million people voted for him. They pushed forth Donald Trump because of the dying American empire and the impact it's having on colonial capitalism domestically. So here we are in the belly of this beast. The question is, what do we do as it's collapsing, as it's dying? We're in the belly of this beast. So now we see domestically, there's a $6-7 trillion national budget, a $36 trillion national debt. Who did you borrow the money for, and what did you spend it on? It sure wasn't on us. So you see all of this happening in this capitalist system, and here we are in the belly of the beast. The world is waiting for us to rise up. We are 50 million strong in America, 1.4 billion in Africa, And when you combine the Caribbean, Central America, and South America, it's another 200-300 million of us. So with all of this, we have to come up with the structure, the organizations, the united fronts, the coalitions, the alliances, to rise up in the belly of this beast and strike a mighty blow against colonial capitalism. And we could do it on a local level. We could do it in our local communities, getting involved in organizations, whether they're in the electoral arena or not, that's fighting against capitalism.
So much has been said. And one of the things that struck me is the mentioning of a united front. About a year and a half ago, during the electoral campaign here in the U.S., the presidential campaign, we talked, our brother Daruba Ben Wahad, shout out to Daruba, he called for a united front against fascism. And, you know, we had a number of different people on our platform, shout out to Black Power Media, that discussed, you know, different politicians who came on, everyone from Cornel West to Jill Stein and Claudia De La Cruz, and yourself as well, and many others. I just caught a press release to something that is along those lines that you're involved in. It's the Fourth National Black Radical Political Convention. Give us a breakdown of what that is, how it relates, and how we the people, freedom fighters and everyday people, can get involved in what's going on.
Well, thank you so much for that. You know, in 1972, Gary, Indiana, was the Black Political National Black Political Convention. At that convention, under Mayor Hatchett and Amiri Baraka, so-called Leroy Jones then, and Carl Dix, I think it was. Anyway, they all got together. Over 10,000 Black people came from all walks of life, from socialists to communists to atheists to Democrats, Republicans, you know, Black revolutionary nationalists, cultural nationalists, all got together, and they were supposed to come out of that convention with a Black political agenda and an independent Black party. Well, I felt that the convention was hijacked by the neoliberals of the Democratic Party. They came in with 2,300 people elected to office. 10 years later, after the convention, they had 10,000. But they were all from the Democratic Party, neoliberals, and their conservative liberal agendas. The Black Power movement went back to our communities, and in Newark, they, you know, Kenneth Gibson, he wasn't us, but that's what Mary and them got him in, and other Black, but see, no Black radicals got elected. This is part of the reason why, when I came out of the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seale had run for mayor of Oakland. This was a year after the convention in 1973. Shirley Chisholm ran for president in 72, and the convention refused to endorse her. It's interesting, the Black candidate and Black convention, and they wouldn't even endorse Shirley Chisholm. She's not a radical revolutionary, but she was some degree unbought and unbossed and said some powerful stuff against the Democratic Party. So Elaine Brown ran for council, and then Huey Newton, when he was incarcerated, was running for Congress, and Eldridge ran for president, Peace and Freedom Party. So all of that stuff was happening. So we decided that, you know what? We got to build a national Black radical political Congress. And our principles would be anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism, for reparations, for the freedom of political prisoners, and running Black radical candidates for local races. And you can either do what we did and strategize in the Democratic primary, or you can be an independent organization like the parties that we have in our coalition or in our Congress. We have the Independent African Independence Party under Brother Khalid Rahim, and then the People's Progressive Ujamaa, People's Progressive Party, Ujima, under Nnamdi Lumumba. So they run in the general. We strategize in the primaries. So now, this is our fourth year. The first year we had in Pittsburgh, we had about 60, 70 people and representing 10 different states. Very meaningful conference. We did it again in Maryland and then again online. And this year it's going to be in Philadelphia. And our theme is, you know, political unity for fighting fascism. So we're going to use that as a theme. And we're going to have workshops. We're going to show how to beat the machine. There's going to be workshops on showing the limitations, how to, what do we do beyond the Democrat and Republican parties, and then just a whole bunch of workshops on a lot of things that's happening. Black African liberation, the Sahel will be mentioned, and also the Palestinian liberation and stopping the genocide. So we're hoping to get a bunch of people there on October 25th and 26th at Temple University in Philadelphia. So you can go to nbrpc.org, nbrpc.org, and you can register for the convention and you can see the hotel arrangements. We want to get all folk out to PAM Africa is going to be helping us in Philadelphia, and we want to get all roads leading to Philadelphia so that we can do a couple of things. One, at that convention, we have a national newsletter we'll be putting out to raise consciousness. And then we're going to see which candidates we can support across the country that are Black radicals, whether they're running in the general election or the Democratic primary, and see if they could adhere to our agenda, our principles of unity, and then get people elected to power positions. So, and we, because we've done it in East New York, we have the model. And now if we could use that across the country. See, when you get in executive positions, it's hard. Right, when you go for mayor, governor, president. You know, look at Ross Baraka. He has his challenges in Newark. And Antoine Lumumba had his challenges in Mississippi and Jackson. And so did Chokwe had challenges. And I'm not saying don't take those challenges on. But once you get in the city council, you don't have to compromise like that. I mean, I don't have to worry about no white money or Wall Street, none of that. You know, my community is 90% Black and brown, so I could blast away. And then the resources and influence is awesome. So, you know, feel free to reach us at my email, Charles Barron, CharlesBarron, as an Operation Power, at
gmail.com. We like to thank Brother Charles Barron from Operation Power. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back with you. I've been your host, Kalonji Changa. Thank you for listening to us today, and look out for all that we have coming. Peace.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I... Hard times like, yeah. Bad trips like, yeah. Nazareth, I'm f***ed up, homie, you f***ed up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright. And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the face down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. We're pretty Benjamin is the highlight. I tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy. Tell them all to come and get me, reaping everything I sow. So my karma come in heaven, no preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a f***ing gangsta in silence for the record. Tell the world I know it's too late. Boys and girls, I think I've gone crazy. Trying to side my face this all day. Won't you please believe when I say, when you know we've been hurt, been down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We
could live at the mall. I can see the evil, I can tell it. I know it's illegal. I don't think about it. I deposit every other zero. Thinking of my partner, put the candy, painting on a Rico. Digging in my pocket, in a profit big enough to feed you. Every day my logic, get another dollar just to keep you in the presence of your Chico. Ah! I don't talk about it, be about it. Every day a sequel. If I got it, then you know you got it. Heaven, I can reach you. Pet dog, pet dog, pet dog, my dog, that's all. Pick back and chat, I trap the back for y'all. I rap, I black on tracks, so rest assured. My rights, my wrongs, I write till I'm right with God. When you know, we've been hurt, been down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
Nights in my prayers.
I remember you was conflicted. Miss you.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of